this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So one of the teachings that I have investigated a lot is the 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action. And so they have the 5 precepts in them, but they also go in more into depth into speech and into the mind as well. And what's interesting about it is in Buddhism we have what's called right view. And that's the first factor of the Eightfold Path. So when we're meditating, when we're developing the mind, if we start to take up the Buddha's training, then the main path is called the Eightfold Path, and it has 8 factors. And it starts with right view. And Samaditti is the name, so it's like the perfection of view or correct perspective. And so it's like the way that we see the world. And there's a worldly kind of Dhamma, which is in Buddhism as well, which is around when Buddhas aren't around, which is like where we, you know, still learn to respect our mother and father. We learn the power of giving. We know that there is like a order of respect and these kind of things. They're like worldly Dhammas. And then the Eightfold Path is like Dharma that's for enlightenment. So it has like another level where the purpose of it is to extinguish the fires of the mind. And in Buddhism, we have three unwholesome roots, which is like greed, hatred, and delusion. And so the opposite of greed is non-greed. The opposite of hatred is non-hatred. And the opposite of delusion is non-delusion. And to develop these things is kind of the purpose of the Eightfold Path. And so it always comes back to right view, because if we don't have a correct perspective, if we don't have a correct foundation, then, you know, how will our meditation and how will our actions lead us in the right direction? You know? So I think that's why we need a little bit of wisdom at the start of the path. And so the 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action, I think, are one of 15 ways of understanding right view. And so the idea is that we develop an understanding that suits our temperament. You know, in the Majjhimanikaya, Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's right-hand man, the monks kept asking him, is there another way you can understand right view? And he kept expanding different ways. And I think there was about 15 different ways. But the problem with the suttas is they're so dense, you know. So the average person, you can't just pick these up and understand them and be inspired by them that easily. So the thing is, we just take a little bit, you know, we just learn. So that's what I did. So this is the very first one in that sutta. It's known as the 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action. Abstention from killing, from stealing, from sexual misconduct. And then it goes into the four types of speech: abstention from lying, abstention from malicious speech, abstention from gossip, abstention from idle chatter. Did I say four or five? Anyway. And then it goes into the mind: abstention from covetedness. So that's where the mind wants things. And then abstention from hatred. That's where the mind's averse to things, even irritation. And then the final one is the perfection of right view. So actually looking at the opposite of this, that's the whole path to enlightenment right there in right view. And so the idea is that we choose the right view that's suitable to us. So then as we meditate over time, we then have to turn back and use out the power we've developed from our meditation and our mindfulness to come up with our own understanding. Because it's one thing if it's in books or we've heard it, but another thing where we actually take it into our own heart and start to see it for ourselves. And so that's why we don't blindly believe in Buddhism, but we take things on board, but then we have to see it for ourselves. So it's like the idea is that there is ignorance, and because of ignorance, we crave for things, and that craving leads to suffering. Just like if a loved person dies, we don't want them to die, and then it leads to pain, suffering, anguish, all these things come up. Even though we all know when we're born, eventually we're going to die, but we're not ready for that because we haven't developed our minds. And so Buddhism is about learning the reality of things so that we don't hold too tightly. So when something changes, we don't suffer because of it. And then that's the cause of suffering is ignorance. And because of ignorance, we crave. And that craving leads us to go out into the world searching for happiness. Where the Buddha has said that, you know, there is an end to suffering. And the cause for the end of suffering is the Eightfold Path. So that's when we practice right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And in the West, we just want to pick up the meditation. You know, we're just like, I'll just meditate. But, you know, when the Buddha taught the Eightfold Path, he said it's like you have eight different chariots ready, and you ride one chariot to the next chariot, and then you could get off and get on the next chariot, and then the king rides to the next chariot, and so on. And then you get to the end, and then you come back again, and you go forward again. And so we're developing all of these eight factors. And so if we just want, you know, peace in our meditation, but we don't want to develop our speech and our thoughts and our actions, then you know, we might get some good results, but it won't lead to the end of suffering. So, but at the same time, we just have to take whatever our ability is. You know, I like Ajahn Chah's aspiration. He said, you know, whether one life or 10,000 lives, you know, he's going to give his life to the Dhamma and just try and practice. You know? So to begin with, we just have to accept where we're at and then work with what we got. You know, there's no point like beating ourselves up if we're not, you know, the same as other people. We just accept where we're at. And then, you know, some people, they're not ready to practice for enlightenment yet, but they can still become a good person. So in Buddhism, the three foundations are to remove evil, to do good, to purify the heart. That's it. It's not very advanced. It's a very, very simple teaching. And so we can all see, I mean, people don't like the word evil, but the problem with bad things is they can become evil, you know. And we see that one of our problems in society is we stigmatize people who've done bad actions. So rather than seeing that actions have a cause, so if we can see that actions have a cause, then people have the ability to change. So, you know, we're not a sum total. We're not that. Those actions are not us. They're something that we've done, that they're within our power and range to change. And some people just don't have that ability. So that's why, you know, we have to look after our own minds. It'd be great if we could look after other people's minds. You know, that's usually what all of our thoughts of irritation in our mind are, trying to fix the people around us. But we don't want to look in the mirror. And so I always see when irritation is coming up in my mind, I say, ah, okay, you know, I have some work to do. Or greed or whatever. Delusion is harder to see, because delusion is where we're kind of our mind. But in Buddhism, they have the eyes are very strong in similes. There's one sutta, one teaching that says, the seven factors of enlightenment are makers of vision. So basically, they're the things that lead us to seeing correctly. Where the five hindrances, which is usually what our minds are submersed in, they're makers of darkness. So they cause lack of vision. And so what I like about the meditation is it's kind of like a depersonalizing process. So the five hindrances, as I've said in the past, sense desire, anger, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, doubt. So whenever we're not practicing the seven factors of enlightenment, we're practicing one of the five hindrances. So rather than getting involved with the stories of our mind, we can say, oh, jeepers, my mind's really restless today. Or, you know, oh, I'm really doubting whether this is the right way to practice, you know, rather than just doing the meditation. Or, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, what I would have for lunch tomorrow for the whole meditation. You know, I have a lot of sense desire today. So rather than thinking that there's a problem that our mind is thinking, we can just see that, oh, this is a hindrance arising. And then over time we learn, you know, how our mind works and how we can substitute or use another technique to overcome that particular hindrance. And so I think the emphasis on meditation in the West is a little premature, because if we focus more on the foundation, like of the mindfulness and the generosity and the kindness and all these things, then we come to meditate and the mind is very close to samadhi. And so the Buddha had what's known as the six recollections of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, virtuous behavior, generosity, and the five qualities of a deva. And the idea was that these are like contemplations that you can put your mind on. So it's like for the sila, which is if you're keeping the five precepts, you'd reflect, you know, this sila is unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped at, leading to samadhi. So they're all things, each one of them is a contemplation. And then we want all these deep dharmas, you know, we want I want to know all the factors of dependent origination. You know, I want to, you know, constantly read the Dhamma. And it's like, well, you know, just if we start with something simple and we learn to inspire the mind, then that will lead the mind close to samadhi. Because actually what we need is mindfulness. You know, we need mindfulness. So if we can learn to inspire the mind, then the mind will be naturally close to mindfulness. And so, and they, when you look at the suttas, they were the regularly taught to lay people. You know, the Buddha would instruct in learning to give, which is like dana, and because that overcomes sustained miserliness and brightens the heart and leads to prosperity, because you're not focused on worldliness. And then sila, which is virtuous behavior, like the five precepts, and that leads to the mind becoming blameless. So you never have to question yourself. You know, somebody says you're a terrible idiot, you can look and see you don't have a tail, you know, you're not a dog. and then bhavana, which is mental cultivation. So that's where we spend our time reviewing our actions through the day and strengthening our mindfulness. But if we're too dry, then we don't want to practice. You know, our mind just gets aversion to the practice. So that's why the Buddha had those six recollections. And when I was really getting into my practice some years ago, I just chose two of them. So I chose the Buddha Nisati and the Sila Nisati. And then that was, you know, I could contemplate one of them for an hour on my walking path. And it's only a sentence long. So it's like we don't necessarily need lots of stuff. We just have to practice with what we've got. And then so when you come back to meditation, then you have the... because your actions are getting better, then the mind settles down more easily. You know? A lot of the problems that we have, we can slowly overcome. Like I used to have a problem with gossip a bit. And so what I would do is I would visualize the person, you know, who I was going to gossip about. And then I visualized them next to the person I was talking to as a way of cutting off that conversation. Because if you're not going to say it in front of them, why should you say it? You know, you're just adding things that don't need to be said, causing yourself difficulty. Because if that person found out, then, you know, that'd be suffering for both of you. And things like that. So it's like, but that's why I any of the right views are very powerful. So the reason I was saying that is that if the 10 wholesome and unwholesome courses of action don't interest you, then you find another right view. Like the other one that I developed was the ayatana, which is the like the six sense bases. So you have the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. And then basically in Buddhism, that's one example of the world. You know, we think of the world of the universe and all this, but if you actually look at our own experience, it just comes from those six spaces. You know, and then what happens? It's this: the eye goes out to sights, ear goes out to sounds, nose goes out to smells, tongue goes out to taste, body goes out to touch, mind goes out to mind objects, and then we react to perceptions. And then there's a pleasant feeling, an unpleasant feeling, or an either pleasant or unpleasant feeling, and we react to that. So what we're actually doing in Buddhism is we're retraining our perceptions. So we go, okay, you know, when I see that person, rather than feeling anger, you know, I'm just going to have equanimity to them. Because I don't know why they're behaving like that. You know, maybe they've had a really hard life. Maybe they sleep on a bed of nails. I don't know. And then so you can have compassion. But if we don't look at our minds, then we can't change those things. So I think that's one good thing of meditation, is that we can start to see what are the things that are actually coming up in our minds. So we have an opportunity to deal with them. And then back to the simile of the eyes. When Moggallana, which is the left-hand disciple of the Buddha, the Sariputta is like the wisdom disciple, and Moggallana is like the one who had incredible psychic ability. Like he could make a mansion shake or the heavens shake with his big toe. And when he asked the Buddha for a teaching in brief on enlightenment, and the Buddha was teaching him about feelings. And a part of that was basically saying, you know, whatever feelings there are, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, which is like all feelings, all six senses, don't cling at them, don't grasp at them, let them go. And then that's basically a teaching in brief to enlightenment. You know? So it's not an advanced thing, it's just that we are so wound up in our stories, in our belief systems, in thinking that the past and the future is real, that we're not present to what is actually here now. And then because we're reacting to these stories constantly, then that's what's leading us to suffering. So an arahant, an enlightened being, is somebody who is no longer fooled by the world. Now they can let go. So even if bad things happen to them, they won't cling to those feelings. But yeah, why I was saying that is then after that, it was interesting in the... that was called the Are You Dozing Moggallana. He wasn't enlightened yet, but he was sitting there meditating, nodding. He wasn't really present. And so the Buddha gave him a whole bunch of different things to do to try and wake himself up, like, you know, rub your arms and limbs or get up and look at the stars. But one of them was wash the eyes. No, it wasn't wash the face, it was wash the eyes. And that always struck me. So there seems to be, in the teachings as well, it says in one place that meditation is when you relax the body, relax the eyes, and the mind doesn't flow out after the asavas, so like out into the world. You know, the mind is just gathering into itself, basically. But it's interesting. So we have this common theme of the physical eyes, and also then that relation with the spiritual eyes, like the fact that the seven factors of enlightenment are makers of vision. So, I think that's a very interesting theme. And then that comes back to the right view, that when we have this correct perspective, this correct way of seeing the world, then that's what we're growing. So that's the point of our meditation, the point of our mental cultivation, is over time to move ourselves in a direction where we actually understand these things. And there's one teacher called the Salaka Sutta, I think Majjhimanikaya, middle length discourse is number 8. And there the Buddha, one monk is asking the Buddha, you know, about the jhanas, because they don't have the jhanas yet. Or one of their disciples doesn't have these deep absorptions of meditation. And the Buddha said, well, these deep absorptions, they're pleasant abidings here and now. But these 44 Salaka, which are like spiritual observances, that's what leads to enlightenment. And even the contemplation of these 44 things leads you in the right direction. And then it gives you four or five ways of contemplating each one. For example, you know, there is wrong view or there is right view. And taking the right view is like the high road. Taking wrong view is the low road. Or one is, you know, there is right effort or there is wrong effort. Wrong effort leads to suffering, where right effort leads to the extinguishment of suffering. And so this idea that we have to wait until our meditation is perfect, until we develop our own understanding, and the Buddha said the opposite of that. That, you know, if we ever find ourselves stuck in our practice or in our lives, we can just use our own logic, our own understanding to try and correct the situation, to try and learn the right way of living. But of course in Thailand and many teachers, they teach us to develop a lot of peaceful meditation, because then that peace is a foundation for the mind. But as Ajahn Chah said, it's like when the chicken's in the chicken coop. When the chicken's in the chicken coop, you know where the chicken is. The chicken's outside the chicken coop, chicken's lost. And so that's like our mindfulness. If we have enough peace in our mind, that when we contemplate, we don't proliferate, then our strength of mind is strong enough. But if we start contemplating and it leads to inversion, or we start thinking about lunch, then we know we don't have enough peace in our mind to contemplate. So, but you know, obviously it's still good to develop the peaceful side of the meditation. So there's two sides. There's investigation, and then there's like the samatha, which is like the developing peace. But even something like the breath meditation, the way the Buddha teaches it, has 16 phases. So it starts with the mindfulness of the body and then goes on to mindfulness of feeling and goes on to mindfulness of mental states and then goes on to contemplation of truth. And it's always the contemplation of truth that actually breaks your attachment to suffering, you know, the causes that are leading you to suffer. Anyway, that's a lot of information. So. But so just as we have three unwholesome roots, we also have three wholesome roots. So even though sometimes we may think our practice is going terrible or things are going bad, usually, you know, there's at least one wholesome root in our mind. So it's like even the Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin, you know, the Buddha didn't always kept hoping he would change his ways because he still had one wholesome root in his mind. And it wasn't until towards the very end, till the pride and the greed overcame him, that the final third root became dark as well. And then when a person's in that state, there's nothing really... you can't really help them anymore because their mind is consumed with darkness. Doesn't mean that in the future life and a future time they won't have another chance. But the idea is, you know, we can only go so far helping people. So when somebody has chosen a wrong path and they've taken it to its ruin, we can still have, you know, metta and equanimity to them. But when we look in our own minds, we shouldn't be too quick to beat ourselves up as well. You know, we have to learn to encourage ourselves. Like, well done. You know, if you're new to meditation and you just meditated for 20 minutes and your mind was thinking for 18 minutes and you had 2 minutes of peace, then you say, well done. You did a great job. And, you know, and as I've said in the past, one of the best ways to meditate is to try and practice mindfulness through the day. So we choose little activities like, every time I make a cup of tea, every time I'm driving the car, you know, I'm just going to try and have silent present moment awareness, just try and be aware of what I'm doing. And then if you have a very thinking mind, you can try the like Mahasi side or the Burmese tradition where they use mental noting, where you can say like lifting, pouring, walking. Because the idea is you're just trying to chop out your thinking, because the mind is like a restless monkey. And if we just let the restless monkey be a restless monkey, then the mind will never find any peace. And then so by the time we come to meditate again, the mind will be all agitated and we'll spend our whole meditation just trying to calm it down. So, and then every meditation we do, all we're doing is dealing with the backwash of the of letting the mind run loose. But like anything, it's like a skill, like a carpenter. So the Buddha's simile for breath meditation, it's like a turner. Like, I don't know if you know, they have the lathe, and then when how they cut the wood, they kind of push into it and move along, and then lift up and push in and move along. So they have to have mindfulness of the contact onto the wood, moving along and coming out. So when we start, you know, we're starting with the body, because the body is very easy to become aware of. So that's why the breath is useful, is any time of day we can sit down and like, right, I'm going to be with the breath. If you can't be with the breath, well, you're probably not with us anymore. So as Ajahn Chah said, you know, if you don't have time to meditate, well, do you have time to breathe? It's like we all like, what's important in our lives? We always, even if we just have a few minutes through the day, you know, like 5 minutes, 1 minute every 2 or 3 hours, where we come back to the breath and then have a short meditation in the morning or the evening when it's quiet. That's enough just to develop peace through the day. And it has a profound impact on our life. And so when we look at the world so full of agitation, these aren't small things. You know? Our modern world, most of the suffering in the West is in the mind. Our physical lives are quite comfortable. Of course, we still break bones and have some uncomfort, but the general level of our lives, a lot of the suffering is in the mind. You know, it's through the depression and anxiety people have. So regular practice is a good thing. So now we'll do the little meditation for half an hour. So just get yourself in a comfortable position. Body upright but comfortable. Feet and hands in a comfortable position. And setting up the mind and the body for half hour meditation. If you like, you can take a few deep breaths. Just let go of all thoughts, problems, concerns, tensions. Just coming into the present moment. Just bringing this kind awareness to the present moment. Allowing the mind, the heart to settle, the body to settle. Just start by scanning through the body from the tip of the head down to the toes. Just slowly scanning through the body, relaxing every part, bringing mindfulness and awareness. Get to the toes. Relax the toes. Relax the feet, ankles. Relax the lower legs, the knees, relax the thighs, whole of the thighs, the hips, the waist. Everything in this region, relax, letting it be, letting it go. Relax the belly. Just become aware of the belly from inside out as it rises and falls with the breath. Some people watch the breath of the belly because it's very grounding. Relax the base of the spine and the lower back, moving up the spine and the back to the middle back, upper middle back, up towards the shoulders, come around the front, relax the diaphragm, the chest, the heart, let go of all tension in the heart, relax the lungs, just become aware of the lungs as they fill up and empty. This natural process of breathing. Coming more into the present moment. Relax the shoulders deeply, right out to the tips of the shoulders. They might droop a little as the shoulders are permeated with relaxation. Letting all tension unwind. Relax the upper arms, elbows. Lower arms, the wrists, the palms of the hands, the backs of the hands, the fingers, the thumbs, the fingertips. The collarbone and the neck, everything inside the neck, all the muscles, pipes, everything, the spine, completely at ease. Relax the jaw, the lips, the tongue, the cheeks, under the nostrils, the nose, the upper cheeks, the bags under the eyes, the eyelids. You might notice a slight smile at the corners of the eyes themselves. Let's bring deep relaxation and luminosity to the eyes. They relax deeper and deeper. As the eyes permeated with relaxation, suffused, filled. Relax the eyebrows, the temples, and the forehead. Any lingering worries and concerns, just let go of as we relax the forehead. It's usually the place we show worry. Just take some time to relax. All the lines of worry vanish. Everything is good enough just as it is. The ears, the top of the head, the whole of the head, the whole of the body. Just allow the body to look after itself for the rest of the meditation. Just accept any lingering feelings with kindness. We bring our attention to the mind or the heart, whatever you want to call it. Put down the past. The past is gone. Put down the future. The future hasn't yet happened. We put down all our expectations, imaginations, and thoughts in the present. Just relinquish the tendency towards thinking. Come into the present moment. As if the whole world were to vanish, we were just comfortably meditating, relinquish all tendencies towards action, and be content to be here right now. Wherever the mind goes in the meditation, we just try to be its friend. If it goes off, we go with it. Eventually it will come back. Just have this kind awareness. It's useful this time, take up a meditation object. So if you have one that you prefer, please take that up now. I'll do a bit of a guided meditation with the breath. It's either at the belly, at the lip, the nostrils, or following the flow of the breath into the chest and back out again. You just choose one method to be with the breath. It seems like it might suit us. And stick with that for the meditation. We have an in-breath and an out-breath. We just have try to have this friendly awareness to the in-breath. This friendly awareness to an out-breath. Just being content with this simple task. Whatever happens is good enough. We find ourselves going off. When we're ready, the mind will come back. The heart will come back. We just recommence. Like a dear friend watching the in-breath, watching the out-breath. What's its feeling, its texture, its temperature? Its length? Like a mantra, and say Bud with the in-breath, Do with the out-breath, or Peace with the in-breath, Full with the out-breath. Sometimes if the mind is busy, it's useful to use a mantra. Awareness of the in-breath, friendly awareness of the out-breath. Breathing in is the present moment. Breathing out is the present moment. The luminous heart, content to be here right now. Breathing in is the present moment. Breathing out is the present moment. I'll be silent for the next 10 minutes. Just be with this kind awareness, content to do our best to practice. Whatever is good enough. Content to be here right now. Tuning into peace with the in-breath. Tuning into peace with the out-breath. Either keep meditating or follow me for a little contemplation at the end. Liberating the mind, I breathe in. Liberating the mind, I breathe out. Freeing the mind from all troubles, concerns, and shackles. Untethering, untying. Liberating the mind, I breathe in. Liberating the mind, I breathe out. Sense of freedom and ease. Openness and well-being. Thanking ourselves for willingness to practice, sharing this goodness with those in this room, those in the world, with all beings everywhere. May all beings be free from all forms of suffering and have a luminous heart. One minute to quickly summarize. So earlier we spoke about the 10 wholesome courses of action and then how they are a form of right view, and that if we have right view, it's like we start to have eyes of vision and we can see the correct path. So that's the evening. We finish with a little chat. let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtues, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guiding spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Thank you for all coming. Just one note, the last Monday of the month, there won't be a talk. If you happen to forget, there'll be an hour meditation. Yeah, I don't mind. But do you want to, anybody want to come next Monday?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, next Monday's to London. Okay, thank you.
Sapa Buddha Nupavena Sada Soti Pavantu Te Pavatu Sapa Mangalan Rakantu Sapa Devata Sapa Dhamma Nupavena Sada Suti Bhavantu Te Bhavatu Sapa Mangalam Rakantu Sapa Devata Sapa Sangha.